Welcome to the Be Well Buzz podcast, your number one weekly source for natural health and wellness.
This is your resident nutritionist, Sean Stevenson, and today we have a very special guest for you to really give us the in-depth information about an epidemic that's actually going on in the Western world. And the funny thing about it is that not many people are talking about it, and it's because a lot of people don't know about it. You know, when our pets get sick, you know, our pet dog or our pet cat or something of that nature, we typically, the first thing that jumps to our mind is it's got to be worms. You know, it's got to be some kind of infection of a parasite of some sort. But when we get sick, when a human being gets sick, it's anything other than that. And this is something that we're going to look directly at because, in fact, there are actually hundreds of different types of parasites that can affect the human body and lead to all kinds of degenerative issues, chronic and acute issues, ranging from headaches to weight gain and all manner of things. And the expert we brought on today, and he's an absolute expert in this field. His name is Dr. Keith Scott Mumby, and we refer to him as Dr. Keith. And he's a British MD now living in California. He's been at the cutting edge of alternative medicine for almost 40 years. So we've got four decades of experience here on this other line today. He was a pioneer of the food allergy and clinical ecology movement in the 80s and 90s. So he's one of the people who really kicked this whole thing off with understanding about food allergies. And known to the press and TV in England and Europe as the world's number one allergy detective. Because of his amazing recovery cases, this is how he actually got this title. He's published dozens of books and has a very large, incredible free website at www.alternative-doctor.com. And that's where you can go and get tons of free information and learn more about Dr. Keith. So, Dr. Keith, welcome to the Be Well Buzz podcast. How are you today?
Sean, hi. It's great to be here, and I'm just fine today. All raring to go.
Wonderful. Well, the first question, you know, the textbook question that we always want to find out, and I'm curious myself, because we haven't talked about this yet, is how did you actually get into complementary/alternative medicine? You know, being an MD, having that background, how did you actually get into this?
Yeah, well, it's a good question, and it seems like I've been forever, you know, on this side of the fence. But I did go through regular medical training. You know, I say outrageous things sometimes, and people get brought up and say, hey, are you a real doctor? And I say, sure, I'm real. Come and touch me. But you know what I mean. They think I can't be a proper orthodox doctor because right. I hold such contrarian views. But I did a regular, you know, medical study, went through med school. I learned to be, in Britain, we have to be certified. We have a bachelor's of medicine and a bachelor of surgery. That's our qualifications, kind of the equivalent to an American MD. I used to win prizes and, you know, represented the medical school in competitions. I was no dummy, in other words. But I got disenchanted even before I qualified, you know. I got rather tired of the story. In those days, I mean, those were the early days, back in the 60s, relatively early days, you know, of drugs. But even then, I could see where it was going, you know, that drugs were just kind of masking things. They weren't producing real recoveries. So I started asking my own questions, and pretty soon I got onto things like, you know, nutrition and holistic health, where what we do, instead of taking over, like doctors do, they take over kind of arrogantly and say, well, this is all, you know, it's messed up, it's busted, we'll fix it, or patch it up, I should say. Our view is that nature is wise, and nature will heal almost anything. Hey, if you break a bone or you lacerated a muscle in your leg, it would heal. You know, you just hold things in place till nature heals it. Nature heals. I don't think any doctor ever healed anything, actually. The best you could do is set the stage, and then it's nature that does the healing. Well, once you start with this kind of inquiry, you pretty soon steer away from drastic things like, you know, surgery and complex and rather toxic chemicals that we call drugs. And you come up with a different story, and that's really where I was at. And pretty soon, somebody told me about food allergies. I never heard about that in med school. And I thought, well, either this is crazy or there's something to this. And instead of saying, well, it must be crazy, like most of my colleagues did, I decided to find out. And I put patients on diets that excluded likely troublemaking foods. And wow, you know, within weeks, I was completely changed over to this. You know, I saw people blow away their asthma, get rid of their drugs, arthritics, that could hardly walk, suddenly had no more pain, and they took up tennis and things. Got one woman out of a wheelchair in those first few weeks. So I was, from then on, I was converted, and that's way back when. That's the late 70s, early 80s, Sean. So I've been at it ever since, and I just don't prescribe drugs, never have in those years. If somebody wants that kind of approach, I just say, you know, go and see a colleague of mine. That's not what I do. And I've never been unhappy with that choice. You know, I made more friends this side of the fence, spend more time with patients. And it's been a great way to practice medicine, in my opinion.
That's fascinating. You know, one of the big underlying components of my work and of individuals like yourself who I greatly admire is just really focusing on what works. Aside from the whole typical strategy that we're taught, you know, when we're going through the medical paradigm, you know, basically prescribing medication, we're taught pathology, studying disease, obviously, and pharmacology, you know, really treating
right.
symptoms. And I found it so fascinating that instead of just doing the thing that works and then kind of basing our practice around that, that we would have to go through the whole rigmarole and have this standard of treatment. And when someone switches over and becomes a so-called alternative doctor, I don't really particularly even like that label, because you're actually a real doctor. You're a true doctor. You're somebody who does things that actually work. You actually see your clients get well. And we have a tremendous amount of things that we can discuss, because you're experiencing so many different things, from obviously you mentioned asthma and allergies and things of that nature. But today I'm very excited and curious myself to talk about this issue, because it's something that we have yet to talk about here at Be Well Buzz. And I've seen this actually quite a bit in my short 10 years of experience, but it's something that we don't really talk about. So first question I have for you is, why are parasites such a huge issue that no one is talking about?
Well, there are two questions, really. Why they're not talking about them, I don't know. They should be. But I can tell you why they're a huge issue, Sean. They've been living with us since the dawn of time. There's actually a very interesting model biological theory. I don't want to get too technical, but it actually has a name. It's called the Red Queen scenario. And I'm serious. The biologists and the zoologists write about that. And what they mean by the Red Queen is running like hell just to stay where you are. You know, it's something the Red Queen in Alice in Wonderland, not Alice in Wonderland, Alice Through the Looking Glass. And this is the story they have now, which is that parasites attack us, so we evolve genetically. We're trying to get new lockouts to get rid of the parasites. We win a little bit, but then the parasites get smart and they get new genes to learn to break back in. And this sort of backwards and forwards battle has been going on, and it's probably the real origin. Believe it or not, wait for this, Sean, but it's the real origin of sex. It's why we have sex. It's the only way to really beat these parasites, is to keep swapping genes and keep, you know, changing our genetic patterns and altering the gene pool. And you only do swap genes, of course, by active sex. Otherwise, why wouldn't we all just divide in two? It's a lot easier, and some very simple animals do it that way. More fun, of course, with sex, but there is actually a reason for that, and it's this Red Queen scenario. So parasites are really important in our history. If you're, and they're also a way of that we get cold. You know, they're not so healthy, not so strong and robust human beings get pulled down by parasites, just the same as weak buffaloes get pulled down by the wolves and things. It's a way of kind of culling. So parasites are not that big a deal to someone who's very robust and has a strong immune system. And that's fairly typical of people in the West and in the developed world. But if you're compromised in any way, you know, you've got mercury or other heavy metal poisons in your body, or you're eating stressful allergic foods, or you've got HIV, or any reason why your immune system would be compromised, these things are there, and they can switch from being a nuisance to being killers, like overnight. You know, they can overwhelm the human body given a chance. But they're with us all the time. They're everywhere. They're diverse. Listen, there are so many. I think it's, what was it, National Geographic, that's it, said parasites have killed more humans than all the wars in history. That was a series, an award-winning documentary series they did called The Body Snatchers. So if you can imagine that, they're big, and we should be talking about them. There's this kind of mythical idea they don't affect us. You know, we're clean, we have, you know, flush toilets and clean plumbing and water at the faucet. It just isn't true, Sean. You know, they're very, very prevalent here indeed. In fact, there's somebody at the Centers of Disease Control who said that in terms of numbers, there are more parasitic infections going on in the USA than in the whole of Africa. That's right. This guy was called Frank Nova, and he was at the National Institutes of Health. So they're with us. That's the message. They're here, so it pays to get wise.
So the problem is even worse here. Is that what you're saying?
In some ways, yes. I mean, there are certain diseases we don't have. You know, like malaria is not that big a deal in Northern America, although it's coming north, you know, and so is dengue. You know, dengue is now over the border and into the southern USA. But we have a different range of things, you know, particularly worms. Trichuriasis and things like that, and pinworms, 20% of kids in the USA have, you know, we're talking like 40 million people just affected by a few worms alone. Enterobiasis, it's called, pinworms. 5.5 million children in the USA alone. And I don't like to confine my conversations just to the US, Sean. You probably know this tendency, you know, like so many Americans are affected with this, and 55% of Americans that. I have a worldview because, you know, I practice medicine all over the world. But just in terms of the USA, 40 million people are infected by pinworms. That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
Toxocara is a pretty vicious parasite that it's passed to humans from cats and dogs. Listen, you can hear it in the name, Toxocara, toxic, you know. Toxoplasmosis is another one. In the very name, they've got this toxic concept. But anyway, Toxocara affects 14% of the U.S. population. That's about 1 in 7. Probably has to do with the fact that Americans love their pets. You know, they love cats and dogs. But if you're going to be around them and these pets are going to lick you and slobber you all over the face and kiss you, you're going to swallow the worms inevitably. And people just have to get wise to this and realize what they're up against.
So are there some other types of parasites that are a big concern here? And where do they come from? I mean, obviously from interaction with our pets, yeah, that's definitely a concern. And just something, you know, we don't want people running out, I got to get rid of my dog or whatever. But just being conscientious of this. But I'm curious, so what other types of parasites should we be just concerned about, knowledgeable about, and where do they come from?
Well, but the big category, of course, is worms. Well, there are two major categories. The worms and what we call protozoa, that just means single cell organisms, whereas, you know, worms, they're multicellular. And there are various types. Let's take the worms, for example. I think everyone's heard of tapeworms. You know, those are the big flat ones that look like pieces of tape. And there are three main ones, the pork one, the beef one, and the fish one. And they're pretty grisly, you know, when they get into you. I mean, often the first you realize is this strap hanging out your backside. But the fish tapeworm can be a monster. It can grow to 30 feet or more, and that's longer than the human intestine. It can take up so many nutrients that the person gets anemia, you know, and it's not rare, especially, you know, I live out west here in California. People love their sushi, but that's raw fish. That's a way you're going to get sooner or later, you'll run the risk of getting infected with a fish parasite. There's a great raw food movement. I respect it a lot. But, you know, if you don't cook your food some of the time or some of the food, you run the risk of picking these things up. And that's what happens to us. So the worm family, anyway, are particularly troublesome. There's the little thin ones I mentioned, the pinworms, and then there's one called whipworms because they look like whipworms and hookworms. Now, listen, let me take hookworms. There's a big worm called Nicator americanus. Its Latin name means American murderer. It's pretty dramatic, isn't it? But that sort of sums it up, really. These are pretty dangerous. Ascaris is even more dangerous. These beasts can grow to about 12 inches long. And whereas one won't be much of a problem, people often end up with hundreds of these things in their gut. They're carrying around 10, maybe 20 pounds of worms in their gut. It sounds horrific, but it does happen, and it happens quite a lot. And these particular worms, the hookworms and Ascaris, are not rare in the southeast of the USA, far from rare. In fact, you know, I joke about this, but it's not really that much of a joke. People from Europe coming to the USA, you know, should be really careful of their hygiene, wash their hands, because, you know, they might pick up some infection that they otherwise wouldn't get. So I really want to dislodge from American minds this idea, well, it's not really us, you know, it's people who are not clean, dirty, other people, you know, from other countries, doesn't affect us. It most certainly does, and it's a very important point.
So you mentioned, you know, even with National Geographic, that this is basically being considered a silent murderer, you know, a silent killer, silent epidemic that's going on. And there's a reason for that, that it's silent, is that this is usually operating, if I'm picking this up correctly, in a way that we don't particularly know that these parasites are in our system and doing their dirty work. Is that right?
That's right. Well, doctors tend not to think of it. It becomes the sort of, if you can't think of anything else, hey, maybe it's a parasite, you know, and then they look. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the more, you know, the other countries, you know, like the tropical countries, it's usually the first thing that a person
wow.
thinks of, you know, because they're so common. I mean, obviously, malaria, if anyone comes down with a fever and starts shaking with a hive, malaria is the first thing you'd think of. It would practically be the last thing a person would think of in the USA. But, they're really big parasites that are... I don't even do these in my book. By the way, I do have a resource book if people want to read more. But I don't even do the tropical ones because they're not that relevant. They're important. But there are so many in the Western and developed world. We don't need to be, you know, distracted by things like malaria and trypanosomiasis. These are important. You know, if you take the global... Let me give you a couple of statistics, Sean. Of all the potential arable land on Earth, there's about 8 billion acres nearly. Less than half of that we can farm because so much of it is rendered unfarmable by parasites, particularly the trypanosome one. That, you know, that causes sleeping sickness. There's an area in Africa the size of the USA, that the whole of the USA, that can't be farmed. Now, this is at a time when, you know, we need food more than ever. The population's growing, and, you know, there's more and more pressure on our land and arable resources. And yet, because of parasites, we can't use half of the world's farming land. It's a huge problem. But those parasites are not necessarily the ones that are relevant to the Western world, but we have our own range of these things. You know, I've mentioned that there's flukes. I mentioned the tapeworms and hookworms and things like that. Those are what the worms family, and there's lots of those, and they're pretty grisly. But, you know, there's other Giardia. I think most people have heard of giardiasis, Giardia lamblia. Typically, that's a sort of, you know, bellyache, not feeling so good. It's a cause of chronic fatigue, persistent diarrhea. It rarely gets thought of, and it's deadly to try and diagnose as well. It's one of those, even if you suspect it, it's very hard to pin it down. You can take stool samples, and it won't necessarily show up.
Right.
In fact, the sort of state-of-the-art test really is called a rectal biopsy. You can probably guess that, but, you know, it means going up with a proctoscope and taking something from the back passage, and that you might catch it that way. But it's very common. You know, I think about 15% of the U.S. population are infected by Giardia. Some worse than others. Some are really ill with it and don't realize. And others, it's just, you know, just mildly gripey. But it depends on the host. You know, if the person's immune compromised, then it can explode inside them and kill them in no time.
Yeah, I came across some research a while back about our methodologies for testing for parasites, and basically it only covers a few, but there are hundreds of different parasites, if I remember correctly, that can affect the human body, and, you know, just
yes.
going and getting tested, you know, you can miss a lot of stuff. Is that correct?
It's correct, and I'll tell you what's wrong with that, Sean. It's that most labs are not very good at it for the reasons I've just explained. They don't think of it. You know, they put a sample of feces comes in. You know, I mean, who wants to do that just before the coffee break? So they give it to the junior, you know, and the junior doesn't find it. And often the senior doesn't find it either. In fact, I've had heated correspondence with one lab. A lady was very indignant, but, you know, she said they weren't missing them, they weren't there, and I showed her the proof that they were actually missing them. If the laboratory can't spot them or recognize the parasite, then you're going to get a bad diagnosis, aren't you? You know, you're going to be told it's all clear, whereas, in fact, the person was infected. And that's typically that's the biggest problem of all. I pinpointed two or three labs in the USA that are highly reliable. You know, they give the best results. But the typical hospital laboratory down the road, you know, run, you know, Humana and things like that, just simply do not have the standard of diagnosis for parasites that's required. These are tricky killers, you know. They're masters at disguise. They're masters at getting under the immune system, and it can be quite difficult to pin them down. So you're absolutely right. They're getting missed over and over and over, and even
so how,
when a person is tested. Sorry?
How so? What are they doing to hide out? How are they so tricky to find?
Well, one of the things they do is suppress the immune system. So the immune system won't respond and won't produce antibodies. I mean, that's a good clue to parasites. You know, if you want to know if you've had the pork tapeworm, you do the pork tapeworm antibody test. Seems logical, but it doesn't work. You know, if there isn't or there hasn't been triggered an immune response, then it's going to be there but won't have declared itself. And this can be the problem. And actually, there's probably a minute to mention that as a kind of funny reverse thing. They suppress our immune system, and just once in a while, that's useful to us. And there are interesting stories of people recovering from severe asthma and autoimmune diseases by actually taking a deliberate infection with a relatively tame hookworm, not the nasty ones, but the pig whipworm. It's very difficult to establish in humans. It doesn't live in us typically. And so people actually dose themselves with a parasite specifically with the intention of shutting down the immune system because, you know, their asthma is so bad. So it could even work in a sort of favorable way in that sense. But that's, anyway, the point I'm making overall is that they suppress the immune system.
I had a chance, of course, to go through and look at your site and your program. On one of your particular programs, specifically about parasites, you've got some pretty revealing images of these parasites. And it's, I know everybody that's listening, you know, this is it's a pretty creepy topic, but it's something that we all need to be aware of. And I want to make sure that everybody's really empowered and understanding about all the different things that are going on in our world today. Because our goal here is to be exceptionally healthy. And that all starts, and it's something that Dr. Keith keeps on mentioning throughout this that I want you to hear, is that it's really boils down to having a strong, robust immune system to the degree that you can actually help to defend yourself against that. So I hope that everybody's really picking that up, because that's where we're going to end up focusing, because there is light at the end of the tunnel, definitely. But we've got to get the information. We've got to keep going with this. And my next question, I guess, you know, what are some of the other symptoms that are associated with parasites in the body?
Yeah, well, it depends, of course, on the type of parasite, but we've talked a lot about worms, and it's fairly obvious that those attack the guts first. You know, typically you swallow the eggs and they run right there. But they do, you know, they do walk around us, Sean. You know, like they may start in the gut, but then they get out and they start walking through your tissues and walking through your muscles. It's really creepy, you know, that these things just think of us as a highway. You know, we're just like some pavement to them, and they just walk along. And they can walk through your lungs and then through the heart and out the other side, through the next lung and up through your, you know, through the neck. They're pretty mobile, and it needs a, you know, pretty strong stomach to face all of this stuff, really. As you say, there's some pretty graphic, I didn't put the most grotesque ones. It's pretty scary, but
thank you.
Graphic images of what they look like. And, you know, when you hammer these things and start killing them with, you know, remedies, herbal remedies or drug remedies, you often get, you know, half-dead things crawling up your gullet and coming out through the mouth or down through your nostrils. You know, they want to get out as they're dying, and they come down and they're visible, and it's, wow, you know, it's pretty horrible stuff. Anyway, I don't believe that was the question, was it? What was it? Oh, yeah, you're other ways to suspect these things. Well, obviously, from what I've just said, any kind of strange, flitting, moving, you know, pains and stabbing pains that come and go in your muscles, that would be something to think of. Fatigue and feeling down, a common one, that's partly to do with the nervous tissue symptoms, but also, you know, when the immune system's down, we get pretty fatigued. That's more or less the common denominator of all chronic fatigue states, is the immune system is down. In fact, it's arguable, you know, which way around it comes. We also get a lot of skin conditions. The skin will often react to a parasite, and in fact, a mysterious rash that is, you know, is rather persistent, even if it's a simple, obvious one like eczema. But the one to be very suspicious of is hives or urticaria. That's a classic allergic reaction. And if a person has hives that comes and goes, the doctor must think of the possibility that a person has a parasite and they're reacting to that, you know, it's living in their gut, say, and causing an allergic skin reaction. But the most missed category of symptoms, Sean, is emotional moods. I've seen people in the most peculiar moods, you know, with strange obsessions and peculiarities that actually turned out to be just a parasite thing. With the parasite gone, the person didn't have these strange moods at all. So someone could easily get written off as a bit of a crank, you know, a bit of a crackpot or a loony, and there's actually nothing wrong. It was a parasite. Their brain was fine once they were cleansed of these things, because they are quite toxic, and that will affect brain function. And brain function covers just about everything, doesn't it? You know, it would you could have any imaginary symptom. You can imagine a pain in your leg, or you can imagine voices in your head, or this, that, and the other. All of these things become possible if you have inflamed brain tissue. So almost anything could be a parasite. So it's very important that we think of it.
You know, it's some of that can actually sound a little bit, you know, metaphysical or kind of airy-fairy, that a parasite could shift your emotions and your feelings and your moods. However, it's important for everyone to understand that every single entity on the planet has some form of consciousness. They have a certain resonance or vibration that their atoms are spinning at. You know, this is very real stuff. And to have another entity basically infecting your system, or basically latching on to what's going on in your cellular community, all of the cells throughout your entire body are communicating with each other. And this is happening instantaneously. This isn't something where something travels from your toe to your brain to get information. It's instantaneous. So it's very, very real that if an individual was infected by a particular parasite, that this would be affecting their mood. It would be affecting their emotional fitness and their you know, their general feeling tones and the way that they are operating in the world every day. It's very real, and I appreciate you for bringing that up, because that's something that we can take a direct look at. You know, if you've gone through a lot, if you've tried so many different things, if you've been confused as to why you're having certain health issues or emotional issues, what Dr. Keith is sharing might be something that you want to take a really, really good look at, because it might actually yield some significant solutions for you. So next, let's get out of the gloomy stuff, which is, you know, it is really creepy. Let's get into what we can actually do to protect ourselves against these parasites. What are some simple strategies to employ just as a protective mechanism?
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, you're right, Sean. There are two aspects to, you know, beating these critters. One is to block their movements, block the transmissions. And the other one is to, you know, get rid of them once they do get on board, how to kill and eradicate them. And there's no question that, you know, preventing them, this is one of the places where you really want to think preventive. Trust me, you really don't want these things on board in the first place. Avoidance is by far the best strategy. And to avoid them, you've got to be parasite conscious in a number of ways. And there are three big things that you need to bear in mind now that affect us and have made this such a big problem. First of all, it's been said that the world is a village today. Everywhere is so close to everywhere else, and that in just a matter of hours you can change continents. And a person carrying an infection who may not be you, and it may not be some dirty, unwashed person, you know, it's just somebody who went on holiday to Africa, may bring it to you. So you've got to worry about that and what your contacts are. We're also suffering from the problem of climate change. Now, I don't want to get into the arguments about global warming and fossil fuels. That's irrelevant. The point is that there's no question that the U.S. climate is gradually warming, and you can monitor this easily by the fact that mosquitoes are moving north. And they're moving north so much faster than everyone. You know, people kind of predicted this, but it's kind of happened overnight. A guy called Paul Epstein, he's a physician who's worked in Africa, and also he's been on the faculty of Harvard Medical School. He says, you know, we're just not worried enough. They projected things to occur by 2080, but they've already happened. You know, by 2010, already these biological systems and insect vectors and things have spread. So we've got to worry about that too. For example, the Asian tiger mosquito, that's the one that carries dengue. You know, that showed up in Amsterdam in North Europe, and it's now crossed the border in the USA. The particular mosquito that transmits it here is now in southern USA. And the other thing is food. You've got to think of food. Food comes from all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could be sitting down eating a nice, healthy, fresh salad that maybe you even bought at a farmer's market, and they weren't, you know, very honest. It didn't come from the local farm. They bought it in. But it may contain parasites like Cyclospora, for example. There was a notorious outbreak of that in California where they served some, I think it was infected raspberries at some kind of conference for anesthesiologists. And as a result, there came a day when all of a sudden there was almost no anesthesiologist in the state of California who could turn out for work. They were all sick at home, groaning in bed, and hospital lists had to be canceled. It turned out the common factors, they were all at this conference. That was something that came in from somewhere in South America. I can't remember all the exact details of the story. But, you know, it was just infected fruit that looked nice and delicious and healthy, nice raspberries with some cream, delicious, you'd think. It laid everybody low. So you've got to worry about where your food comes from, too. And I'd worry even more about China. You know, China's got a lot of endemic infestations. And yet so much of the food you buy in a supermarket now, supposedly fresh food, comes from China. So you've got to be aware of all these things. You've got to be aware that parasites can be transmitted from water, infected water or infected food, as I said, uncooked food particularly. So you've got to think of fruits and salads. If you cook it, it's not that bad a deal. You can get it from other humans who are infected through touch and sex, and it can actually be as simple as just touching a doorknob that somebody else has touched. You know, there's a couple of eggs on it. You touch the doorknob, the eggs are on your fingers, you touch your lips, and they're in. That's how it can work. So it's not all just down to mosquitoes and these things called insect vectors. But you've got to remember pets. I'm sorry to keep hammering pets, but, you know, I cringe when I see the way some people fawn over their pets and lick and slobber. I'm like, oh, my God, you know, especially if it's kids. I don't like the idea of kids picking up worm eggs from their pets just through being sort of lovey and cuddly and friendly with pets. But then there are other animal vectors, too. You know, cattle and pigs and things, these are obvious on the farm. Everybody would think of those. But what about raccoons, you know, these little animals that run around in the woods and occasionally show up in the yard? There's a very severe and dangerous worm that grows in raccoons. It infects the brain, and it can be fatal to human beings. It can be really deadly. You wouldn't normally think of that. But, you know, kids shouldn't be playing in sand pits where animals from the wild can get into the sand pit and defecate, and that it leaves a source of infection. So you've got to be very conscious of all these points of access, if you like. I mean, they just come at us from so many ways, Sean.
Yeah, I've got to interject.
But the only way you're going to keep them out is
one tiny story, because you brought something up that just like, in my mind, it clicked that I remember when I was a kid, I was probably 8 years old, and I was playing with my neighbor's dog. I'll never forget this. I was the sickest I've ever been in my entire life. So I was playing with the neighbor's dog, and we were playing catch. You know, I was throwing this ball to the dog. It was kind of a scary-looking dog. And then I proceeded to, later on, I was biting my fingernails, you know, just a kid, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember I was so sick. I was literally sick as a dog. And I remember that so clearly, like just feeling like I was a dog. And it's like, now that I've listened to what you had to say, it's kind of like I was picking up some different kind of emotional stuff was going on. And I was coughing like a dog. And I was this little boy. And, you know, since then, of course, you know, I've done a tremendous amount of cleansing, and in particular, parasite cleanse, which I'm sure you can give us some insight into. But I just got to reiterate the fact that that's a very real thing. It's a very real concern. And, you know, we don't want to operate in our world, again, in a state of fear. We want to operate from a state of being conscientious of, you know, the inherent dangers, because, you know, the world is built on a platform of there's this whole circle of life, and things are giving and taking, giving and receiving from many other things, and it's just the nature of the whole game, so you need to be conscientious of these things. So what would you say, because these three big things that we need to consider, number one, we're now in a world community, a world village, as you called it, and just to be conscientious of, you know, the travel and, you know, the people that you're coming in contact with and what can potentially be there as a hazard, the climate change, something else to consider, and then, of course, the food and water. And this is a very this is something here on thin ice for us, because we're here, we're all about nutrition and food, and raw food in particular is a big highlight for us. So what I'm picking up, what I'm hearing, is that we need to be more conscientious of where we're getting our food from. If at all possible, you know, growing some of your own food, getting your food locally, and to the best of your knowledge, you know, really be adamant about that. And, you know, this is gonna come up as a question, because I've got clients that are international. I've got clients that are traveling even right now. Water and boiling water. Here's the thing. Yes, you can boil it. You can kill the parasites. But when you consume the parasites' dead bodies, are there's still going to be poisons in there? Am I correct? That can make you sick?
Yeah, to a degree, yeah. I mean, obviously, there's far more toxins come from living organisms because they're constantly excreting. Right. But yeah, you know, even when it's dead, it's not good for your body, is it? These things, they're not just like another source of meat. They're quite toxic little brutes. Some of them deliberately toxic. As I said, that's how they operate. You know, they poison out the immune system. That's how they get along in the world. But that's not good for us, is it?
Absolutely not. And this is, you know, this lends to the question. And I know you've got a whole protocol designed to help in this situation, but just what are some walkaway things that we can consider when, you know, trying to utilize strategies to get rid of parasites if we happen to become infected?
Right. Well, you know, you said it yourself in a way, like clean, fresh food that's not supermarket food that you can't source. And it's not that you can't source it. You can rely on the fact it's probably come from China or South America or somewhere cheap. You know, you were probably brought up on the, I don't know how old you are, Sean, but I mean, I'm 66, 67 in a few months. I was brought up in the farm in the old days, you know, when the food was there with you, you know, and nature rotated the food. You know, summer there were tomatoes, and then when the tomatoes were done, there was the autumn fruits. Now you can have tomatoes every single day of the year because somebody somewhere is growing them and they get shipped to you. So the less you rely on food like that, the better. But if you are using supermarket food, at least wash it, you know, reasonably. I don't think you have to get paranoid and wash it in Clorox and stuff. But, you know, give it a good wash and a good clean. That brings me to a whole other issue, of course, and you did mention it. Like, what do you do when you've got them? I mean, keeping them out, we've said, is best. But if you've got them, what do you do? Sometimes they're pretty severe, you know. Strongyloides, for example, and I mentioned Ascaris. These are pretty dangerous brutes if you can. You want them out fast. And, in fact, sometimes it actually becomes a matter of a surgical operation. You know, open the gut and pull them out in the hands full. You know, I've seen like half a bucket full of worms come out of somebody's gut. It can be pretty grisly. If a person's in danger or in trouble, you may even consider regular, you know, drug treatments like metronidazole and nitazoxanide and things like that. Now, you know, Sean, you and me, we're not particularly into drugs. I only stress that if it's severe, if it's dangerous, you've got to be realistic, and sometimes it's right. Necessary to go the whole way. Those treatments, in fact, all parasite treatments are toxic. I'm going to talk about the herbal ones and the nice, friendly-sounding holistic ones, but, you know, don't be under any illusions. They've got to be poisonous, otherwise they're not going to kill the parasites. They're poisonous. They're going to kill you as well if you're not careful. Well, not kill you, but they're going to make you feel sick. And when you wallop a bunch of parasites, you can actually, there's a thing called worm wobble, for example, where simply the brain just malfunctions because of the huge amounts of dead protozoa and dead parasites that are in the body. Poisons out the brain, and the person can't even walk straight and form their words properly while they're going through that process. So, you know, it can be that severe. And as I said, I don't want people to be unrealistic and thinking, you know, lovely sweet old herbs. You know, Artemisia, especially the absinthium one, you know, absinthe. In fact, you know, that was probably, that drink was so popular centuries ago because it did poison the parasites. You know, people would sup absinthe and poison out the worms. It's probably good, but it's pretty toxic stuff. You know, it rots your brain. It's still, I think it's still illegal in the USA, certainly in most states. Artemisia absinthum, anyway. There's another Artemisia, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. But I'm just saying, don't, you know, be realistic. They all have potential severe side effects because you're killing living organisms that are a bit like us, really. You know, they got muscles and nerves and things like we have. There's a very good, the best of the drug substances that I know, I just want to make people aware of, is called Alenia or nitazoxanide. And a doctor, a great guy called William Stuppy, who practices in Los Angeles, did a very interesting protocol using that stuff, basically using, you know, quite high doses. But look, let me tell you the figures he got. This is what he quote. The cryptosporidia was reduced by 99%. This is based on antibody testing, you know, not measuring or catching the critters at the in the act. It was based on antibody tests. So when the antibody levels dropped, that meant the parasite was gone. Okay, Entamoeba, Histolytica, that was down by 100%. Giardia, I mentioned, was able to reduce that 98%. Ascaris, that's one I mentioned, I keep mentioning that big, nasty, toxic worm, down by 90%. That's not so good, but that is a brute, that one. Pretty good with the pork tapeworm, 100% successful, and so on. So if you follow Stuppy's protocol, and I support this protocol, I've written about it, and it's actually in my book. Do you think this might be a good point to send people off to, you know, get the book?
Absolutely.
We'll mention it a few times, but the website is pretty easy to remember. It's parasites911.com, parasites911.com. That's 911 as digits. So you can, you know, you can back up all these good things that we're talking about. But that's it on the what you might call the orthodox or conventional approach. And I'm not against it. You know, if the person's sick enough and if a person has, you know, a cyst in the brain, I'm not against hitting it with whatever works. We don't want to be too kind of sweet and holistic that we miss the chance to beat these things up, right? But then there are lots of holistic herbal type things that are mixed in various ways. And some are pretty strong, some are, you know, not maybe not that good. But you typically people like to mix them up, don't they? You know, you get formulas. And there are a few worth mentioning. You know, black walnut husk, for example. Now, it's got to be the husk in the green phase, not in the black phase. It's called a black walnut, but it's too late then. You need it while it's green. You take the husk and shred it, and that makes a pretty powerful anti-worm substance. And I mentioned Artemisia. Artemisia absinthum is the one that gives us toxic absinthe. But the other one, Artemisia annua, not quite so toxic. It grows here, and it's called sweet wormwood, or sweet Annie. I think it's got various other folk names here in the U.S. It's still toxic. Just don't be naive. That's what I'm saying. In fact, Artemisia annua, I don't know if you know this, Sean, but it's being worked on with the World Health Organization as probably the number one anti-malarial right now. Did you know that?
I did not.
It's proved really successful, especially when it's combined with an anti-malarial drug. So the two together is good. You've got citricidal, that's grapefruit seed extract. Not quite so toxic, but then not quite so effective, you see. It's a kind of trade-off. Oil of cloves is good. And hyssop, you know, hyssop's a great one. There are a lot, I don't know what you do here, but in Europe we have lots of monasteries that make wines and health wines. Buckfast in England comes to mind. And, you know, my wife were in Normandy about 6 weeks ago. And we went to the Benedictine monastery where they make the liqueur, Benedictine. Most of these are based on herbal formulas and particularly include hyssop. Now, I don't know if it has a special U.S. name, H-Y-S-S-O-P, hyssop, but it's a great antiparasitic, beautiful flavor and really enhances these, chartreuse and Benedictine liqueurs that you can get and drink. So I'm not saying I'm necessarily recommending those as a health drink, but the monks do. They claim all sorts of amazing health benefits for it. And then there's a whole bunch of other stuff, Sean. We don't need to delay too much, but, you know, ginger root and peppermint leaves and black seed, fennel seed, all of these things, you know, enjoy varying good reputations. And as I said, it's often down to formulas. You know, people mix up things. The one I like to recommend is called Natural Balance from a company in the UK. And that's an old Persian remedy that's been in the family for nearly 1,000 years. And, of course, you know, parasites have been around a long time. Oh, I just remembered a story I didn't tell you, Sean. There's an amazing excavation in England in a city called York. And its original name was Jorvik. It was a Viking city. Anyway, we don't need to bog down on this, but just briefly, they excavated the old Viking ruins that were under the modern city. And they actually found examples of parasites. They actually found a latrine with old dried-out feces, you know. I don't know if we can use the S word on our shit. Shall I use it? Since I'm a doctor, I can get away with it without being rude, can't I?
It's okay.
But there's a famous, it's called Barclays Bank Turd. It's a bit funny. It's like saying Chase Bank Turd, you know, because it was found under Barclays Bank. And they were able to study the parasite patterns infecting people in those days by looking at these old fecal samples. You know, it's really, and this goes back to the 11th century. About 1020 something. So excavation and archaeology has its interesting side too there, and it just shows you how long we've been at this game fighting these things, you know. In fact, I'll tell you what, what's his, you know Oetzi, the Iceman? Have you heard that story, Sean?
I don't think so, no.
Oetzi, they call him the Iceman because he was found frozen in the snows in the Alps at about 5,000 feet. And he'd crossed the Alps. This is going back 5,500 years. He'd obviously got injured, died, were probably froze to death, but extremely well preserved. And he does have parasites. But more to the point, he had with him a little pouch containing mushroom antiparasitic remedies. He'd obviously been worming himself and had this stuff with him. So even going back 5,500 years, people were up against parasites. And they had some idea what to do. You know, these particular mushroom formulas were, you know, as good as anything I've just been recommending. In fact, you know, fungi and mushrooms are brilliant as antiseptics and antifungals and antiparasitics.
Yeah, and it seems that we've forgotten about these things. You know, I've learned a tremendous amount today. Even though, you know, some of these things are an affirmation for me, but just looking at, you know, the trypanosoma, the giardia, the protozoa, the hookworms, all these different things that people, you know, if you're questioning any of this, you can just go online. You know, the big catch phrase is Google it and look at all these different things that are known to affect human beings, and it's absolutely mind-blowing. But nature doesn't operate in just a one-sided way. There's this amazing gift that it's always giving back because there are solutions there as well. And I really got to applaud you because some of the really great and well-intentioned alternative health practitioners get so far off into, you know, so-called natural approach that they miss out on utilizing the conventionally, produced medicines, you know. So just even... Yeah. Mentioning the fact that I believe you said it's Alinea?
Yes, Alinea or nitazoxanide. That's A-L-I-N-I-A. It's pretty expensive if you get it prescribed here. It's like several hundred dollars for a course of treatment. But if you send the prescription to Mexico, it's actually like $50. Just a quick, you know, a hot tip there. They say the FDA wouldn't like me saying that. But it's the same Alinea.
I so appreciate you even bringing that up, you know, that there are some valuable things there as well, you know. But if somebody's just hearing this and they're just concerned about, you know, maybe I do have an issue with parasites, then what I'm going to do is direct you to the expert, direct you to Dr. Keith, and go to parasites911.com, and that's 911 in numbers. So parasites911.com, and get your hands on his protocol, because I'm sure it can take you step by step. Because one of the big things that I've learned over the years is that something like black walnut husk, for example, there's a certain time period or time frame that you can take that. You know, you actually can't take that stuff every day, long term. It can, like Dr. Keith mentioned, it can harm you, you know, but use in the proper way, in the proper fashion, which he's going to teach you about, you know, with these different anti-parasitic approaches, it can be tremendously beneficial and actually heal you of things that, you know, you didn't even know what was wrong with you. So I really appreciate all the information and the content you shared today, Dr. Keith.
Great pleasure, Sean. Yeah, if I could sum it up in one sentence, it's in this respect, is ignorance is not an option.
I'm going to post that right now to Facebook. I'm going to post that right now. And again, thank you so much for sharing your insight. We've got to have you back on to talk about some of the other amazing things that you know about, you know, talk about allergies or asthma and things like that. If you would be open to it, we can get something set up. How's that sound?
That would be my pleasure, Sean. It's been very enjoyable talking to you. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. So this is Sean Stevenson signing off from Be Well Buzz, and we'll talk with you soon.
Thank you for listening. Go to www.bewellbuzz.com for more natural health information and subscribe to our free weekly newsletter. Don't forget to share this podcast with your family and friends. Stay tuned for more from Be Well Buzz.